This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 115 was recorded on April 26, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Natural resources guru Marin Katusa joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll take a deep dive into the reasons that Marin is long-term bullish on copper and uranium, and we'll discuss electric vehicles in considerable detail.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 on Tuesday took a pretty good dive, trading all the way down to about the 2615 level where there's a fib zone. And then yet today, we suddenly see a huge rebound in the S&P coming back the other way. It looks like the market can't make up its mind. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, Patrick, we've got so much to discuss on equities this week. I want to re-invoke your series of charts that shows how previous corrections correlate with the present correction. And let's save that for our post-game segment after the feature interview. Briefly, though, what I do want to say at this point is my view is changing. And the reason I say that is in the past, I've said, look, I think there's still another leg down coming. But after that, my favored case is a full retrace and maybe even new all-time highs. Now, if we get a pullback from these interest rates that we're seeing on the 10-year, that still would be my base case. I think there is room for new all-time highs. On the other hand, if we get a breakout past 3.05, which Julian Brigden told us was the critical level on the 10-year Treasury where things could really accelerate, at that point, all bets are off, and I would say it's time to think about bear market as opposed to correction. The thing you have to keep in mind, Patrick, is you can't jump the gun on these things because, yes, we have pushed over 3% briefly this week, but we didn't get past 3.05, which is the actual resistance level. And it's exactly what you would expect, is to move up close to it. It's a reason it's called a resistance level. Get up close to it and then pull back from it. Well, we need to do that pulling back from it if we're going to stay on the course that I had charted previously. If we break out well above 3.05, in that case, I think we seriously have to revisit the question of whether this is a correction or the beginning of a serious bear market. Let's leave it there, though, at this point, and come back in much more detail in the postgame segment after our interview with Marin Katusa.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar index here. And we saw at the start of the week a legitimate breakout in the dollar, but I've been essentially waiting until Thursday to see the ECB press conference with Mario Draghi to really see whether the direction in the euro would become more transparent. And we definitely got a euro breakdown to the 121 level, which certainly has now given some tailwind to this dollar index. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, finally, Patrick, we've got a clear upside breakout. Now, as you know, in technical analysis, these breakouts need to spend some time above the critical level in order to really be confirmed. Another sign we might look for is for it to come back down and retest that resistance zone as a support area and then move higher from there. So there's still a few check marks on the technical analysis checklist. But as far as initial indications are concerned, Patrick, it really looks like we're resolving this long-standing, more than 2 months of consolidation with a firm upside breakout. And unless there's a fake break and it reverses pretty quickly to the downside, it looks to me like this thing has some legs to the upside. Now, I'm still very bearish in the extreme long term. I think Luke Groman gets proven right in the end in terms of the U.S. dollar losing its hegemony over the financial system globally and eventually fading into the sunset and losing value, as did the pound sterling. But that's a story that plays out over decades. As far as what happens over the coming weeks and months, all indications at this point look to me as though we're seeing an upside resolution to this big question mark, and it looks to me like it's set to continue.
All right, let's move on to crude oil, because several weeks ago, we definitively broke out to a higher high above that 66 handle. And what's very interesting to me is that we've now spent several weeks trading at higher levels. I mean, I think we're right now at 68 spot 20 on oil. What's your thinking here of where we're going next?
Well, Patrick, I think we're probably going higher in the short term, but let's start with inventory. Crude oil this week, consensus analyst expectations were for a drawdown of about 2 million barrels. Instead, we got a build of 2.2 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 459,000 barrels. Gasoline, building 840,000 barrels. So we got builds across the board, and then distillates were the one lone drawdown, drawing down 2.6 million barrels. Even more bearish than all of those big inventory builds, production plus 46,000 barrels per day at a new all-time record of 10.586 barrels per day of domestic U.S. production. Now remember, Patrick, an increase of 20,000 barrels per day in a given week annualizes to 1 million barrels a year. So at 46, that annualizes to well over 2 million barrels of additional crude oil production in the United States on an annualized basis if we continue to sustain this level of production growth. Talk about bearish, bearish inventory information. Exports came in at 2.3 million barrels per day. On a weekly basis, that's 16 million barrels of oil that was exported that otherwise would have shown up as an even bigger build on inventory. Meanwhile, the dollar breaking out to the upside should be an oil bearish signal as well. Bearish, 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 bearish across the board. What does oil do in reaction to that? Well, of course, it spikes down dramatically on the news, and that lasted all of about 20 minutes, Patrick. And then we were moving back above $68 to a new high on the day, a higher level than before API or EIA's data came out within 20 minutes after that. Well, how is it possible that that's happening? And the answer is, pardon the pun, I think that inventory is being trumped by geopolitics. And in this case, it is the question about whether or not Emmanuel Macron can persuade Donald Trump not to abandon the Iran nuclear deal. And it seems like the consensus is probably no, he cannot. And that we are going to see the United States on May 12th probably step away from the Iran deal and potentially reimpose sanctions on Iran. So I think it's that geopolitical pressure and those expectations that are just overwhelming the system, even though the inventory data that we had this week should have been extremely bearish. So all of the ingredients are still there in terms of the speculative long interest is now 15 to 1 longs to shorts. Everybody on one side of the boat. All the ingredients are there for a big unwind and a huge sell-off. But the thing is, Patrick, it's not going to happen when everybody is very worried about a potential geopolitical escalation with Iran. And that's exactly what everybody has on their mind. So I think we're probably moving higher from here. Iran is going to be what gets us higher. And probably after the Iran situation is resolved, the upcoming OPEC meeting is what will keep us high. After the June OPEC meeting, I think it could be a different story. But between now and June, it looks to me like this market is going to continue marching higher.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, where we have gold trading at 1318 right now. And it's been obviously weakening over the last few days as the dollar's been breaking out. Is the dollar just going to be the driver of gold from here?
Well, normally I would say the dollar in my book is the big driver. That's what we've seen has been the big correlation. Dollar up should mean gold down, so it's a bearish outlook for gold. The thing is, you've got a couple of other factors in the system. Jeff Gundlach making some very bullish comments about gold. Didn't expect it coming from Jeff, actually. Whether or not he's right, it almost doesn't matter. He has a lot of influence. A lot of people listen to him, and he's talking about a very significant upside potential in gold. Meanwhile, this situation with Iran and in general John Bolton in the White House and the potential of further geopolitical escalations, if there's anybody who in the face of a rising dollar can still get gold to rally, it's got to be John Bolton. So I think there are reasons in terms of geopolitical risk to think that gold moves higher here. I'm still leaning from what I'm seeing in the tape toward gold continuing to sell off if the dollar continues to strengthen. 1308 is the key support level, so I'll be watching that carefully. If we have a decisive breakdown below 1308, then low 1200s is certainly possible. Of course, a geopolitical escalation could turn things around in a heartbeat, but right now, if the dollar keeps moving up, I think gold is going to face a headwind here.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield, which is like the second half of April has been defined by a massive breakout in yields from, you know, 275. We hit almost 305 on the upside. At least in the last day here, we've been coming off there. I think we're at about 299 at the moment of taping. What's your thinking of interest rates? Do we break that 305 overhead?
Well, clearly, this is the big macro story, big issue to watch. This is what it's all about. This is where everybody's eyes should be focused. It's beyond my pay grade to try to tell you whether or not we're going to see a breakout past 305. But I'm hearing more and more people. Of course, our regular listeners know Julian Brigden told us 305 was going to be the critical level back in March when he was on the program. Citibank was out this week with a research note echoing the same thing. Don't get hung up on the 3% round number that a lot of people focus on as a psychological round number. Look at 305, which is where the actual resistance level shows up in the charts. Now, Patrick, I'm convinced that Harley Bassman is right, that there is some level on the 10-year Treasury where everything falls apart, equity market falls apart, we get bonds and equities selling off at the same time, and it becomes a major, major financial fiasco at that point. Question is, what is that magic level? Is it a break past 305, or is it not till we get to 325 or even 350? I don't think anybody knows. We'll know it when we see it. When things all start falling apart, you'll see a rapid move up in the 10-year yield. But are we going to get there? I don't know. 305 is the number to watch. Again, keep in mind, the way this works is you tend to go up to that resistance level, faking everybody out. Everybody who wants to jump the gun is saying, oh my gosh, we're going over it. Well, we haven't been over it yet, and you would expect to go up and test it and then pull back from it. And the reason it's called a resistance level is we expect not to go over it. That's the more likely scenario. It's resistance. If we do go over it, it means a new ball game. So right now we haven't broken out past it yet, but boy, if there's anything you don't want to take your eye off of, it's whether or not we break 305 on the 10-year.
All right, well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, natural resource expert Marin Katusa is this week's featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Marin is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Marin Katusa, founder of Katusa Research. Marin, I was thinking about you quite a bit recently as I've been watching the news flow with this escalating tension between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And I couldn't help but think to myself, Donald Trump clearly has not read your book, Colder Wars, because if he did, he would understand the degree to which America is dependent on Russia and trade with Russia. But for our listeners who may have missed your first interview on Macro Voices, please explain what I'm talking about. What could go wrong for U.S. energy policy, particularly if there was a complete breakdown of trade between U.S. and Russia?
Unfortunately for the Americans, a lot can go wrong. So let's go back 30 years. As the collapse of the Soviet Union, the infrastructure was in place with the Russians where they could downblend their nuclear warheads into cheap nuclear fuel. The Americans took advantage of that, and now one in every 10 homes in America is powered from a Russian-sourced enriched fuel. That's on top of one in every 5 homes in America is powered by nuclear energy. So setting that framework, when you understand that the Americans consume a little over 50 to 55 million pounds of uranium a year for their nuclear reactors, and this past year in 2017 produced just under 3 million pounds, they import over 95% of what they consume. So it's by far the biggest energy source that they're importing. And more importantly is Russia's in a situation where about exactly 45% of the world's enrichment capacity is owned and operated by Russians. Now, all of the enrichment facilities in America are actually not operating today, and these are radioactive facilities. So it's not like you can just show up, turn on the switch, open the doors, and get going again. These are radioactive. There's a lot of items that you have to do. So when you look at the time frame, so if Russia does play hardball here with Trump, right now the nuclear reactors in America have just under 12 months of stockpiles that they can consume of enriched material. Now, Urenco, which is a very complicated European structured ownership, they could make up some of that. And a lot of people in the investment community go, well, Canada and Australia can just make up the difference. Well, actually, they can't because the Canadians have a long offtake agreement with India, and the Australians have signed major long off-term agreements with the Chinese. So what will eventually happen is there will have to be a major increase in the spot price for the American facilities to be able to come on, because these are not owned by the government. They're owned by private enterprise, and they've lost money and they've shut down. So will anything change overnight? No, because these nuclear reactors, it's not like coal or natural gas where they need daily feed. These are set up, the rods are there. But, you know, these nuclear reactors, if you think that the price of uranium right now is about $20 a pound, and if it went to $40, let's just say 100% increase, it would not change the spot price of the electricity generated by more than 5%. So for a nuclear utility, they don't really care too much if the spot price is $20 or $25 or $40. What they care about is secure, long-term, stable supply. So this is the first time ever in the nuclear sector that the government of America has found itself in a serious predicament.
Marin, as I understand it, and it's not being reported at all in the press, save perhaps for your own newsletter, Russia is talking very seriously. Russian parliament is considering legislative action that would ban all exports of uranium to the United States in retaliation for the sanctions that have been threatened by Donald Trump. Is that still on the table? Is that still under discussion? And do I understand that correctly?
Correct. It's going to parliament decision for mid-May. In the Russian parliament. And the one thing that people have to understand in the West is our media portrays Putin as a thug, or, you know, as this almost like a warlord or a Slavic brute warrior. But the reality here is he's got complete control in Russia. And if they put this into law, you better believe that they will execute. They're not going to debate it for many, many months like Obamacare or years. This will go into action immediately.
So let's consider the worst case. Russia bans export of Russian and, let's say, Russian-controlled uranium that is processed and refined and enriched by Russian-controlled assets. And that is taken off the market, so it's not available to the United States. Now, you said that the American nuclear energy industry has at most 12 months of stockpiled fuel. So if they start to run out and Russia is no longer a source, are there other sources? And at some point, you'd have to, you know, tool up and start to produce uranium and enrich uranium in the United States. How long would it take to get tooled up and be able to do that in comparison to the 1 year that you said we had of room in terms of stockpiled fuel?
So the world's largest primary producer of uranium is Kazakhstan, and they produce about 40% of the world's uranium. What people have to understand is, you know, if you go to Astana, it's Russian, Cyrillic is the language. It's Russians that operate these things, the key mines, the fuel is enriched in Russia. So even though Kazakhstan is its own country, it is heavily influenced by Moscow. And there's that old saying, all roads lead to Moscow. So don't expect that America will make up the difference from Kazakhstan. Canada, unfortunately, MacArthur River in the Athabasca Basin, which has the highest grades of uranium in the world, recently just shut down. Now, again, just like any radioactive mine now, you can't just shut it down. There's a lot of rehab that you have to do to these facilities. And again, Cameco, which is the world's largest producer, publicly listed producer, other than the Kazatomprom, which is state-owned, Cameco would need a long-term offtake. But again, the enrichment's the issue. So will Areva, the French government, will they step up and help out? Will Urenco, even if all of them help out, it still makes up a shortfall for the Americans. Now, what about the Americans downblending their own nuclear warheads, which they have tens of thousands of course? Again, the facilities are not in place right now to do so. They would have to send those nuclear warheads to Russia, and I don't think of any single American that thinks that's a good idea. So that's not an option. So even with all of the enrichment capacity coming online in America, it's still a shortfall. So unfortunately, Russia has to be dealt with here, and the Russians know that. So it's a serious problem. There's no easy answer.
Well, and Maren, this, as you said earlier, is not something where if the price of uranium goes up a little bit, then it causes demand destruction and all of a sudden the market's different. This is, we've got to have it. So if this Russian legislation goes through, it potentially creates a really profound squeeze and a big spike up in American uranium prices. What if we, you know, obviously there's a temptation there to make an investment play on that, but we don't know if this is going to be resolved or not. What does the case look like for uranium? Let's pretend that this situation with Russia is off the table, that they have decided not to impose these sanctions on exporting Russian uranium. Is there still an investment play for uranium and uranium mining facilities, or does it really lose its merit if this geopolitical situation is de-escalated?
It's a very contrarian play. Me personally, and what I advocate is stay away from any high cost production or early stage, you know, non-North American assets. For example, there's a lot of uranium in the world. If you go to Africa, if you go to the former Soviets, you know, the Stans, as they call it, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, there's a lot of uranium in those areas. But, you know, I just think that the lack of infrastructure, you know, in the Niger and the Arlet Basin, you got a lot of other geopolitical things that are working against companies from the West. And the Chinese state companies, state-owned enterprises, and the Russian companies have an advantage over Western companies in those parts of the world, whether it's politically correct or not to say it. Avoid what I call the AK-47 nations, because, you know, the rule of law isn't necessarily the rule of law. For myself, you want to stick with low-cost permitted producers in the U.S., essentially ISR, which is an in-situ recovery, and then Athabasca Basin, where the grade is king. But right now, there's very few uranium plays that you really need to be paying attention to. It is a inflation adjusted at like a 40-year low. And if you look at it now, you know, just let's say a decade ago, there was over 700 companies that were exploring, developing, and producing uranium assets. Today, there's about 12. So it's a perfect contrarian setup. But again, you really need to know what you're doing. So it's not something I would tell people to run in blindly on.
Maren, I want to come back to the subject of uranium later in the interview, but first, let's assume we can get through this situation somehow with Russia and we have electricity available. Electric vehicles, obviously, are a major topic that is of interest to a lot of people. We've been hearing so much about it lately. You're one of the few guys in the natural resource sector who's really done a lot of research and a lot of work here. So please make the case for our listeners. Why do you think electric vehicles are going to be a dominant trend for many years to come? You know, what's the whole investment case for why this is important?
For sure. Like I spend a lot of my time on the road, and, you know, rarely do people believe governments from, let's say, like China, the data from China. But ironically, if you look at the actual production numbers of the EVs in China, they've been ahead of what the government has mandated. So last year, a little over 1% of all the vehicle sales were EVs, and it's growing and it's accelerating. And ironically, when you look at where we're going in the future, and I'm not saying that all these EVs are going to be Teslas or they're going to be Mercedes. Remember, from a manufacturing standpoint, you're using 80% less moving parts when it comes to the removing of the unions and the reduction of labor. There's all these benefits into it. But essentially, when you look at how these new cities and the grids are developing in the emerging markets, I really believe, and it's not going to be overnight. Like, you're not going to wake up in 2 years and it's going to make up 50% of the market. But over the next 20, 30, 40 years, there's going to be a steady increase in EVs. And it's not just going to be in cars. You're going to see different types of electric vehicles. You go to Mumbai, you go to New Delhi, you go to Beijing. The air apocalypse is real. And even with the emission improvements and the efficiency increase in internal combustion engine, the realities come that the batteries are really decreasing in costs and they're increasing their exposure. And the tipping point may be in 15, 20 years where the internal combustion engine just can't compete with it. And, you know, right now it's a niche, cool thing to have, but eventually it'll become the thing that everyone will go to. And I don't believe that investing in the battery is the way to go, because it's still undecided what the victor is and who says there's only one victor in it because of the composition of the different components it's still very early days in the life cycle of the electric vehicle. But when you think about, okay, 25, 30 years out, today alone, you look at what is the main beneficiary of electric vehicle? In my opinion, it's copper. And I can get into a lot of points if you want why I believe that. But even if we go to 4% of the vehicles sold in China and America, we are in a shortfall for copper. I'm not talking about 30% vehicles sold that become EVs. I'm saying less than 5%. We become into a shortfall.
Well, I think this is so important, Marin, because so many people, you know, they're focused on the batteries, and it just blows my mind. As you said, the battery chemistry can change. Right now, everybody is focused on lithium is what, you know, you need to build the batteries. We don't know if that's going to be it. And the other thing people do is they focus on Tesla, which may be a thought leader in some ways, but they basically build ridiculously expensive cars that most people can't afford. And they really, if you look at the market cap of that company, it's as big as GM or Ford. There's no way that they're ever going to, achieve a profitability that justifies the capitalization they already have. So I don't think that is the play. But as you say, you cannot build these things without copper. So tell us more about why copper. Obviously, it's the key component. Is there a way to build an electric vehicle that doesn't have copper? Is there an alternative to it? And what are the other reasons that you see copper as the way to play this trend?
For sure. So let's just start from the framework on copper. Let's go to the historical. So I've got quite a bit of experience in copper. Like, I've been one of the founders and been on the board of a third largest producer of copper in Canada. And it is not easy to put a copper mine into production. Just let's go back 15 years ago, the actual reserves. So reserves of a mine are, by definition, are what are economically mined at today's price of copper. 15 years ago, the average reserve grade of producing copper mines globally was just about like 0.95% copper. Today, it's 0.37%. So it's dropped by almost 60%, right? So we're talking about a serious decrease and in the actual reserve grades. That's a big one. Now, if you look at the actual cost over that same time frame, it's over doubled to produce a pound of copper. So what are the reasons? Well, the easy copper, if you look at the big, big mines like Escondida, Grasberg, easy low-hanging fruit has been taken. You got to go deeper. But also the governments want their take. So look at what Freeport's dealing with, all the issues with Grasberg, which is a major copper mine. So you're looking at the grades have dropped by well over 50% globally. The costs have over doubled, but the time it takes to permit and actually create the financing for a mine, if you're very successful, you've done it in 10 years. But most of these mines now, you know, because of the NIMBY effect, not in my backyard or where these mines are located, you know, there's some great copper mines in Afghanistan and Iran, but who really wants to go with Western technology and Western financing into those parts of the world? It ain't going to happen. Other areas, infrastructure is so poorly developed that you can't do it economically at $3.50 copper. So last year, the world consumed about 50 billion pounds of copper as its base load. That's just every day with construction. And what's interesting, you know, a lot of people argue, well, Marin, you know, housing is going to, you know, we use cell phone, that they don't have a landline. That is true. But with the smart homes, I used much more copper. My wife and I just finished our dream home, and we used much more copper than a house 10 years ago for the same type of, you know, home security and the home stereo system. You got an automated home. That's true with even EVs. So as internal combustion engines, what a lot of people don't realize is as they become more efficient, you use less gasoline, which byproduct, you use less oil, because oil is where gasoline comes from. But if you want to make your electric vehicle more efficient, you actually end up using more copper. So these are these interesting things that the people haven't start cluing into the copper market. So, you know, there's no new mines. Like, a major Escondida needs to come every year to replace the reserve grades that have been produced. But that's not happening. And, you know, it ain't going to happen, I can guarantee you, at $3.50 copper, because there's no mines that are going to be able to come in. So what people are doing is, you know, they're high grading their existing mines to, you know, capture that $3.50 to keep their mines going. They're going deeper. But you'll notice that a lot of mines are starting to have more wall rock collapses. You know, they're going deeper. They've been depending on the existing deposits much longer. You've seen that at Bimingham in Utah. You've seen it recently in Chile on one of the major copper projects. So you look at China, which a lot of people don't realize is the world's second largest producer in copper. They've also increased their environmental standards. And again, this is a state mandated. Xi Jinping ain't going to be screwing around and waiting for people to debate. Very similar to Putin. When he puts it into law, it's going to go into law. And even though the West thinks that it's okay for China to be polluted, that's not the case. So they're shutting down mines there. You look at the infrastructure in Peru, which is the third largest. You know, there's a lot of issues there. Electricity issues. Remember, electricity is a major consumer, as is water for any big porphyry open pit copper mine. And Chile has its own constraints. So you look at what's going on globally, and you really can't bring on any new copper production big under $3.50 pound copper. So then people say, well, okay, well, we can recycle all those old cars and all the old homes. And what about recycling of copper? Even when copper was at its high in 2011 at $4.50, recycling made up about 18% of the global market. Okay, it's just not economic to do that at $3 copper. So, you know, recycling is not going to replace or fill in the gap for that void of where the EVs are going. So the world's going to consume more copper, but the existing copper mines aren't in place to meet that demand. So from a resource speculator standpoint, that's music to your ears. It's a fundamental setup for a good market.
It seems to me that there's really a double play here too, because what we're headed towards is a new economy, a much more environmentally conscious world where electric vehicles are very much favored and sponsored by governments and encouraged by governments. If that's true, we don't have anything close to the electric distribution grid in the United States or in most other developed countries to supply most people. Have, you know, today you can supply electric vehicles because they're a very, very, very small percentage of the total vehicles in the road. If you had 80% of the vehicles in the road were electric, you would need a whole new electrical distribution grid, really worldwide. How much copper does that consume, and how big of a project would that be?
Oh, it's not possible. Like, so, you know, on top of that, to get to 80%, I have not even, like, I've created some very sophisticated models that major mining companies have been using and comparing to their own data. I don't even get into that scenario because I don't think you'll see copper at $8 to $10 minimum if we get there. And then, you know, one thing I forgot to mention is that's why baseload power is so critical, why nuclear is so important to the North American energy grid, because it's baseload. And when do people power up their cars? When they're not driving them at nighttime, generally speaking. So the other aspect is, you know, can aluminum replace copper? Like in the past, they tried to do that. Well, it was a huge failure, but especially in the electric vehicles where you're looking at high density, you want faster charging times, aluminum is not an option. And when you look at what's going on in China and their new grids, they are definitely staying away because they want to be energy efficient. That's the key for the future. So copper by nature at its price cost is a perfect element for that.
And is there another competing substitute for electrical distribution? I mean, I know that aluminum was, as you say, a colossal disaster due to connections getting corroded, and it caused all kinds of fires and homes burned down. So aluminum's not it. Is there some other alternative substitute for making wire out of besides copper, or is it really a sole source material?
The realistic answer to that is at $3 to $5 copper, no, I don't see a substitute. You know, if copper gets north of $5, $6, $7, $8 a pound, I could see human ingenuity come up with some sort of alloy or some new form. You know, just like when oil got to $125, you saw green energy come in very expensive, but it decreased. You know, look at the cost of solar panels. You know, they decreased by over 90%. I could see that naturally happening, but over the next 5 to 10 years, if copper's under $5, $6 a pound, I don't see that coming into the picture.
There was also something I found fascinating reading your report on this subject. I would have thought, you know, a natural objection, if I think this through, is, okay, the whole point of these electric vehicles is they're trying to make them more and more efficient over time. So as they work toward greater efficiency, does that mean they're going to reduce the amount of copper that goes into the vehicle and maybe throw some of your calculations off in terms of how much copper is required? But you explained in one of your reports that actually the opposite is true in a sense. Please explain.
Yeah, so when you look at how to make things more efficient, number one is reduce the weight, right? And a battery is a big weight. So, you know, the battery costs have been improving significantly. Just over the last 6 years, they've decreased by 75%. But more importantly, it goes counterintuitive to what we've experienced over the last 50 years with gasoline improvements. But as you're using more efficiency, you want more conductivity, you want more power. And the only way to get that is with more copper. There's no way to go around it yet, but maybe in the future they'll come out with maybe get rid of the wires and maybe make a solid state copper where it functions as multiple parts. I don't know. We're not there yet, but as of right now and for the next few years, that's the situation.
Marin, something I've learned from watching the oil markets is you've got to think about supply and demand, not only in terms of the production that's available, but in terms of the incremental production that could be available. You know, in other words, is there capacity for the shale revolution to ramp up and create more, or do we have to go to the next technology that gets that much more expensive? Tell us more about the situation in copper. Is this something where as demand increases, we just have to, you know, turn the keys and open the gate and start up the next copper mine that's all ready to go? Or is this something where exploration and discovery is required before we can produce more copper? What does the picture look like in terms of the industry's ability to scale up as demand increases?
Eric, you just nailed something critically important that the market overall forgets. After the financial crisis, you've seen the majors, the mid-tiers, you know, the first department to get cut in a crisis and when cash is tough is the exploration. It's not like these geologists got dumber, but it was just no money to spend to drill, to turn the rigs. So in the last 10 years, there's been less global discoveries for copper combined than there was in the year 1992 alone. You know, that's alarming. And it's not like you can just say, okay, well, we need more copper. Let's turn on the next copper mine. It's not like the shale sector where you can drill multiple wells and you can increase the production from the same pad. You know, at a mine, you're fixed production, you know, and rarely do mines achieve 100% production because things always go wrong. Mining's a tough, tough business. And, you know, when you look at, you know, in 2016, 2015, 2017, there was no major global copper discovery. These things are two reasons. There's less money in the sector to be spent towards exploration. And number two, these projects are getting harder and harder and deeper to find because we've been, you know, really benefiting from prior generations of exploration. So, you know, when we get to 2030, there's been no discoveries in 2010, 2015 to put into production. That's generally the cyclical cycle of these things. So because the resource markets have been so horrible for the last, you know, especially the last 5 years, there's been very little money going into it to replace pounds produced. Hence why you've seen, you know, the reserve grade go from just under 1% 15 years ago to 0.37% today. So that gives you a good idea of how tough it's going to be in 10 years.
Okay, Marin. So in terms of price elasticity, if the demand goes up, the price goes up, and there's really no getting around it. That's a good opportunity, I think, to segue to a different topic, which is how you approach these things in the natural resource sector. You know, we've clearly discussed in this interview a very strong case for copper and a very strong case for uranium. And you've described in the case of copper, you know, there's no pad drilling for copper. There's a lot of investment required. In the case of uranium, it's an even bigger hurdle because now you've got radioactive mines and so forth, and commissioning these things is a really big expensive undertaking. To me, that just speaks to a lot of complexity, and it makes me feel like, boy, if I don't know what I'm doing, I could really make a mistake. So how do you approach when you see this demand increasing for both uranium and copper, and you can clearly see that the price of these commodities has to go up? What's the best way to play that, and how do you approach deciding what the best way to play it is? Do you look at plays directly on copper and uranium as commodities? Do you look at mining shares? Do you look at companies that do the processing and support of this? And if you are looking at mining shares, there must be a process. How do you decide which ones to invest in? How do you approach this whole picture of getting from copper and uranium prices going up? I got that. How do I get from there to what's the investment play?
For sure. That's a great question. And, you know, everyone has to answer their own risk tolerance. For myself, you know, there's really no great way to invest in the commodity of copper because there's so many different forms. You know, most copper in the world is actually, when it's produced, sent as a concentrate that goes to a smelter. It's more like a makeup powder, but it's around 25% concentrate. What I personally, in this phase of the cycle, is you want to be exposed to the equities, the shares of these companies that have world-class drilled out deposits in jurisdictions that have infrastructure, that are pro-mining, that if you find something world-class, you can actually do something with it. And more importantly, that it has economic accessibility to a smelter. So, you know, how far from a port, you know, if you look at, you know, just a general cost, what are the byproducts? You know, most of the copper production globally are in porphyries, and you get a lot of byproduct, whether it's gold and silver, or if it's a copper moly porphyry. You know, does the byproduct cover all offsite costs like transportation and smelting and insurance and all those factors? Then you look at really, you know, who would buy it? What type of copper is it? Is it clean concentrate? Is it a little bit dirtier concentrate? So, you know, what type of smelter will take that, what type of discount will get applied to it. And what's going on right now, Eric, that the market, unless you're really, you know, knee deep into the sector, mines like Escondida, because they're so important in Chile and it's been operating now for over 20 years, they're going a lot deeper. And as the metallurgy and the geology changes, it has a lot more impurities in it. So it's getting more discounts. So the smelters need a blend. So it needs a clean con to blend with this dirty con. So you've got to know what is the final product. So it's not just geology, it's not just the engineering, logistics, and the cost, but you have to understand the metallurgy aspect. So after 20 years of doing this, you kind of learn a thing or two, you know, the right people when you don't know an answer, how to go through. But you get incredible insights by visiting the project. And that's why I spend so much. That's why I've been to over 120 countries. You go and visit the area, you get firsthand perspective with the ministry officials, the indigenous people, the locals, all the different factors. And it's multiple factors, and you keep learning and you keep going. And, you know, that's how I built up my net worth, is getting in there and really doing the due diligence. But in this phase of the cycle, I think you're going to see some major consolidation from the bigger companies, because they're seeing exactly what I'm publishing. And they know internally that they haven't replaced their reserves that they've produced. And now, rather than playing catch up and it'll take them 15 years, they can now buy something at a 50 or 60, 70% premium at a major discount to what it would cost them to go and do that themselves. That's where I think the sweet spot right now in the current market is.
Marin, something I learned from founding a software company and selling it to a public company is it's almost more important to understand who the buyers are, who's doing acquisitions, and what they're looking for, than it is to know your own business. It was amazing in my experience there. I have to believe the same things are true here. So in your investment process, do you evaluate companies in terms of who's most likely to be taken out in an acquisition, and what are the factors that you look for in terms of finding companies that are going to be good targets? Because those acquisitions tend to be some of the most profitable exits for junior companies and so forth.
Without a doubt, that is absolutely critical. So for example, if a mid-tier has what I believe is a world-class deposit, you got to look at their balance sheet. Every management team thinks that, you know, they're capable of doing it. You really got to find the people who truly are. And, you know, you can take an average management team and they'll screw up a great deposit. But, you know, you want to stick with people. People's an absolute critical factor. And, you know, this, if you find the right, and there's a few out there, there's not many, but there's a few. And you have to understand, okay, what company will come in and buy it, and who can afford it. More importantly, who can plug this into their system? You know, you're rarely going to see someone with no experience in the jurisdiction or that type of commodity will come and buy it out. That's a very rare, you see that at the top of the markets. But right now, it's almost easier than ever to be able to see, okay, who's going to buy this world-class asset off of this miner for 100% premium? And you narrow it down and go, okay, is this bigger company, is their balance sheet, can they afford it right now? Can they digest this acquisition? You know, does their access to their smelter and infrastructure, do they have capacity at this time of their cycle to take these assets on? So all these factors play into it, you know, understanding the balance sheet and the management teams and the infrastructure of the region. And the beauty of the resource games, I've got a lot of friends who've done very, very well in the tech sector. The mining game is such a small, small sector. For example, if you add up all of the mining companies, and Canada is the hub for, especially Vancouver, where my office is the hub for all mid-tier and junior exploration development in the mining sector. If you add up every Canadian mining company together, they're still less than the market cap of Exxon, right? That's just one major oil player. So the mining world is so small, and at these conferences, you essentially get to know all the players, and the Rolodex, it doesn't need to be that big to be able to get to a major president or a board member of the other company. You get to know what their opinions are, what they need, all the factors. So it's kind of a really niche market, and it's been beaten down so badly that I see these consolidation kicking in, and then you're going to see the generalist funds come in when they see these start gains coming in. Right now is a bad market for it, and that's exactly the kind of market that I enjoy because I'm able to get world-class assets at a major discount.
Well, Marin, obviously this is a very complex process that has lots of moving parts, but I'm sure our listeners are dying to know. As we look here and now today in April of 2018, what's your favorite play in the copper space? Do you have a favorite company? And if so, why is it your favorite? What are the things that led you to like that company so much?
Well, in the nature of where I believe we are in the markets right now, where if you're positioned in world-class assets that are undervalued, you know, one company that I'm very happy to share with your audience that I believe is a takeout target before the end of the year is Nevsun, ticker symbols NSU. Look, I bought lots of stock in the company. I always put my money where my mouth is, but they've drilled out something in Serbia that I believe is just the first of multiple world-class deposits. Now, people think Serbia, geez, you know, isn't that place in a war-torn area? No, it's not. It is not an AK-47 country. There is rule of law there. More importantly, there's a long history of mining there. The smelter is less than 50 clicks away. And more importantly, you're getting DRC grades, the, you know, high grade, really high grade. And you're getting it in Eastern Europe where you can just drive to it. I've been to the project. The management team that has discovered this sold out to another company, Nevsun. And I believe right now Nevsun is so cheap that it'll get bought out by a bigger company because that deposit has less than a 2.5 year payback. And that's on the first discovery. So, you know, when you look from a mining perspective where these things are so risky, and if you can get your capital back in less than 3 years at major production, that's a world-class deposit. So that's one that I explain. You know, we just talked about what my framework is. Now I'm telling your people, what is a specific stock? You want to find out all the details. It's very complicated stuff, but it's all there in the report that I'm willing to share with your audience.
Marin, I can't thank you enough for sharing this report with our listeners. I appreciate it is normally reserved for your paying subscribers. And as I mentioned, that service is fairly expensive at about $3,500 per year. My producer, though, Patrick Ceresna, is getting really good at negotiating for discounts for Macro Voices subscribers. So he has worked with your colleagues to get a discount opportunity. It's discounted from $3,500 down to $1,995 per year for a full subscription. Again, a sample issue is available in your Research Roundup email. That is only for 1 week, though, is all we could get it, because they don't give out deep discounts. That's more than 40% off very easily. So that's only good through May 4th, 2018. There is a link in your Research Roundup email. This offer is only for Macro Voices subscribers. So you'll look for the link in your Research Roundup email, which will take you to a landing page where you can get that discount. The link will self-destruct after May 4th. So if you're tuning in after the fact, listening to this interview after May 4th, 2018, sorry, the discount is no longer available. Marin, tell people a little bit more about that publication and what they can expect to get there.
Yeah, so, you know, thanks for providing the opportunity, but, you know, I'm one of the longest writing newsletters, and you know, something your people should know, a lot of the very, very big names in the industry that are known as legendary resource guys, like Doug Casey, who's a great personal friend, like I manage his money in the sector. There's other guys that, you know, have done very well with me, like the guys who run the Agora, Porter Stansberry's crew. These are all good guys that, you know, but when it comes to the resources, when you see the biggest newsletter writers in the game come to me, it's not cheap. It's not for everyone. But most importantly is every single one of these stocks, I'll have over $1 million personally into. And you get to know exactly what price I pay. And more importantly is you get out before I do. So in the newsletter world, I've seen such schmucks and, you know, thieves that, you know, they're talking heads and they tell other people what to do with their money, but they have zero skin in the game. I'm the exact opposite. And the last time I did something where I had such a high conviction was Altera Power. I was one of the largest shareholders and I went publicly going, this is a takeout target and I don't understand why the market's not getting it. That's exactly where I'm at with Nevsun today. I'm a very large shareholder and I believe that it will be bought out. And I just want people to know my style. It's very different than almost all of the newsletters in the business. You'll have videos. So I take a film crew to me to site. So whether it's an underground mine or if it's a the world's largest uranium enrichment facility or an oil well up north or if it's a African mine, I bring my film crew and you get to travel with me and you get to see the pupils of the geologists and the engineers and the management teams. And I'll ask the tough questions because I'm investing my money and you get to see at what price. And that's kind of what we do. And we write very depth reports. We teach, more importantly, how people to invest in tranches. You should never buy your whole allocation in one day. That's a big fallacy mistake of newsletter subscribers. So we teach patience. I call it the way of the alligator and how to survive and do well in a very difficult, you know, market. Speculation is tough, but you can do very well if you're disciplined and you know what you're doing. So that's what I try to share with people.
Well, Marin, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Marin. Now, as a macro trader, I've always lumped copper into this basket of industrial metals, and I've always looked at it, you know, as business cycles, global growth, and, you know, the growth in China as a demand side, and we'll see an economic slowdown and copper slump. But what's amazing is when listening to Marin, it's making me realize that there's a whole supply side destruction element to the story where, in the end, prices at some point have to start rising to levels where geologists actually have the money to actually go and find more of these metals. I sort of think about it and ask the question, is this at the heart of where stagflation can come from? You know, this idea that if all of these suppressed commodity prices start mean reverting back to their fundamental values, is that the backdrop of higher commodity prices pushing higher inflation rates, but doing so in an environment where there's no growth? What's your thinking on that?
Well, Patrick, I think that's entirely possible, and certainly stagflation is what I think we're headed towards in this economy. It's just a question of how long it takes to get there. You know, the thing that really struck a chord for me in what Marin said, though, was the fact that he emphasizes to his readers to buy these things in tranches. Take your time. Don't make your investment all at once because the conditions change. Marin is a long-term thinker. He's got an excellent track record, but he is a guy who thinks about the long-term picture. So he's talking about what copper is going to do over, you know, the next many years. You have to remember that copper is a lot of people's favorite economic barometer instrument. And if we get a recession, which is very possible, I mean, look at what's going on in the stock market, look what's going on with 10-year yields. If we get into an economic recession, you're going to see a sell-off in copper, and it's going to be a better buying opportunity. And I think that's the way to think of it, better buying opportunity. But just keep that in mind as you're looking at something like copper. Follow Marin's advice of not spending all your dry powder right away, because there may be a day coming when there's a cheaper entry opportunity for copper. Speaking of cheaper entry opportunities, I've got to hand it to you, Patrick. You've been doing a fantastic job lately of negotiating great discount deals for our Macro Voices listeners, and I know everybody appreciates it, so thank you.
It was definitely a great deal. But you know, what's amazing to me is, like, you know, Marin, he's really a subject matter expert. I mean, when we talk about guys like Doug Casey, and like he said in the interview, you know, he runs Doug Casey's money. It's really interesting to be able to get the insights from him.
Yeah, you know, Casey is a much bigger name in the newsletter business for sure than Marin is. But, you know, where does Casey put his money in the resource space? He has Marin run it for him. Casey is actually the second largest investor in Marin's fund. And just so people know, because we do have a large accredited investor audience, we did try to get information for the fund. The fund is closed to new investors. So unfortunately, even for our accredited investors who are able to invest in hedge funds, there's no opportunity in that particular area, which is too bad, because Marin returned 30% to his investors in 2017 and 55% in 2016. So he's got a fantastic track record. Needless to say, if you can't invest in the fund, you'll just have to do it yourself, and the newsletter opportunity that Patrick created for you is probably the best way to pursue that. But moving right along, you put together a fantastic chart book again for our listeners, Patrick. And for anyone who is not a regular listener to the program, we've been through this same set of charts several times now, updating them each time, and it's basically mapping historically what do 10% corrections in the stock market look like in terms of how many weeks do they take to play out, what levels do they typically test, and then we're charting the current activity of what's actually going on in today's market on top of that template in order to see where we stand. So let's go ahead and dive into that chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Patrick, walk us through this chart book.
Obviously, the first two charts are just looking back at what we showed in the earlier chart books, but I wanted to move to chart number three, where we really touch on the updated market correction template. And what's interesting is the lows that occurred in early April, down around that 2560 level on the SPYs. So the first two pages are just looking back at what we've shown in the past. So we really want to focus on page number three in the chart book, where we just updated the template with the current market price action. What's particularly interesting is that W pattern, which often is referred to as a double bottom, still very much have been in place. We saw those lows in early April come in, retesting those February lows. And even though the market rallied, we weren't that impressed with that rally. It's something we talked about over the last week. But really, we saw nothing that is actually yet reopen the floodgate to the downside to begin a new market correction. But at the same time, we have not seen any price action to really indicate that the bulls are in control of this. I mean, if I was to give analogies, almost like a rugby scrum, and we don't know who's going to actually run away with the ball here, it seems like we're stuck in this kind of muddle here, and it's not yet transparent as to where we're going. What's interesting, you were referring numerous times that you still think that there could be another leg lower, and we heard Mark Cudmore and other of our guests kind of infer that. But it'll be very interesting. There's some key technical levels that still need to be violated for there to be another downswing in this market.
Okay, looking at slide four here, I want to ask you a question about this, because I see that you have the risk acceleration zone. I agree with that. You've got the danger, Will Robinson. This is where it all comes unglued area, the caution area in yellow and black there, starting around 2560. Now, when we discussed this on the program a few weeks ago, we were talking about a Nomura analyst who had said 2535 was the key level. Why has it moved up to 2560 at this point?
Well, with all technical levels, they always are slightly adjusting as time passes. And this is still Charlie McElligott's work, talking about the cell levels. And going back to that one that we referenced a few weeks back, that level was at that 2535. What's interesting is that the 2560 level now marks the lows of the April low. And what's interesting about that is that that new cell level, they're still suggesting we could see the CTAs with systematic selling still flip max short with a tune of $90 billion in notional supply to sell down at those levels. Now, the way I kind of look at this is that, you know, the bulls, so long as they can maintain the markets above the risk acceleration zone, where we'd see that risk off moment. But what would be really interesting is to see whether, like you were describing before, that pain point, whether the market seeks to discover it, whether this is still going to happen. What's your thoughts on it? You still feel that we're going down to that bottom end?
Well, that's been my instinct. And what I worry about, Patrick, is if we go past 3.05 on the 10-year, that we might keep going. If I look at this chart on page 4 looks very clearly to me like a descending triangle pattern. And if you get an acceleration to the downside where you see the red arrow and the yellow and black caution block here, if you get that huge amount of algorithmic selling by the commodity trading advisors at that level, it's going to create the downside breakout from the descending triangle pattern on heavy volume. And that is going to cause everybody else who sees it happen to say, wow, that's a really strong sell signal. At that point, in order to get a rebound and turn that into a fake break that goes the other direction and recovers fully, we're not going to do that if we're at 3.25 on the 10-year, I'll tell you that. So I'm starting to feel like maybe we need to see an upside breakout from this triangle pattern in order for the bull case to be revived. And if we break down below the bottom of the triangle into that yellow and black area, I'm afraid it could be a one-way trip at that point. We'll see. There's always room for either possibility.
So, Eric, what I wanted to, though, touch on is where is it that the bulls can regain control of this? Because we have to be open-ended. The way I look at it is using that rugby scrum kind of narrative, this could still theoretically go either way. But what kind of bullish constructive price action would we have to see where the bulls can suddenly gain good traction and then take all this risk off the table and then get all the buyers buying again? And to me, that descending trend line along the top end, which kind of pushes down to about the 2680 level on the S&P, is going to be a key level for the bulls to break in order to turn the tides. And we're very much approaching that level. So we should find out in the next couple trading sessions whether or not the bulls have the capability of doing that. As far as I'm concerned, we would have to legitimately clear those mid-April highs just above 2700 with some real momentum. And under that case, I would be more willing and open-ended to looking at all the bull cases of a retest of the highs and things like that on the upside. You know, as far as I'm concerned, we're sort of in this no man land that we could really just let the market tell us. Why are we going to try to tell the market what it's going to do? Let's see where it commits and where the breakout actually happens.
I agree with you. I think that the bullish case, the way you save the bull case here, is a breakout above that descending trend line that is then followed through with heavy volume buying that takes you rapidly up through the blue rectangle above 2720. That's when you say, okay, looks like the bulls are going to save the day after all. Until we see that, though, I think this is a very questionable chart. But Patrick, I want to move on to slide 5, where we're looking at the dollar index, because boy, if I look at that descending trend line that you're showing this time on the dollar index, all those tops lining up so nicely in a perfect line, and all of a sudden, wow, there's a really clear breakout. We had a consolidation range with a top about 90.5. That's been, what, 2 months now since the beginning of February that we've been in that range? Clear breakout. We haven't gone back down and tested it from the other side as a support level yet. It's only been a few days, but everything I'm seeing so far, this thing looks to me like it's got some legs. What do you think?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. It was funny, just last week I'm on the show and we're saying, well, look, these dollar consolidations can last half a year. And then a week later, we're already broken out. It's interesting, though, the fact that there's this much follow through, four consecutive days of where the sellers were not using the strength to sell into. And this is going to be a really interesting test, because we're slowly approaching, as we approach the 92 level on the DXY, you're going to start not only reaching what were the September lows of last year, but also the Fibonacci levels up above. And a lot of traders pay attention to those levels. And I think if we start seeing a dollar index that in any way starts squeezing above those kind of pain levels, we could really see even an acceleration in the dollar. I don't want to jump to any conclusions 4 days into a move, but this is something that has to be on the radar, because one thing we always say in the macro space is the dollar is one of the biggest and most important determinants of so many asset prices. And, you know, so many of the narratives that were running through the entire 2017 year, the whole idea of synchronized global growth and all of the stocks that were being traded, were all based on, in some degree or another, the dollar weakness trend persisting. And so if we see that this is a major reversal in the dollar here, if it develops to being that, that changes the asset pricing of everything.
It sure does. And it brings into question, you know, the whole crude oil story. It's very, very unusual to see a sustained move up in the dollar index and up in crude oil at the same time. Usually there's an inverse correlation there. If we do see them at the same time, you have to think of it as crude oil is effectively increasing in price at a much faster pace than is depicted on the chart, because it's increasing in price while the denominator, the value of the currency it's priced in, is increasing at the same time. So if this crude oil rally is going to be sustained and the dollar rally is going to be sustained at the same time, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But on that note, Patrick, it's time to wrap things up. So listeners, we do need your help. Please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, but most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compilation of links to all of the best content that we could find, both from our feature interview guests as well as other interesting research on the internet. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. As well, you're going to find the link to that chart book that Eric and I discussed during the postgame. There's also an interesting article from Doug Cass about the return of the bond vigilantes. And as well, there's an interesting blog from Jesse Felder on how the flattening of the yield curve could lead to a bear market for stocks. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.